He came from the hills of Jamaica with nothing but a barefoot dream and a voice that defied silence. Before Bob Marley lit the global flame, Jimmy Cliff cracked open the door, with songs that healed, a film that rebelled, and a legacy forged in truth, not trends. From Somerton to Soweto, from protest stages to spiritual retreats, this is not just a story about reggae. It's about resistance, exile, resurrection, and rhythm. This is the untold journey of the man who made music into memory and memory into movement. Not just a legend, but a living drum. Many Rivers, the cinematic life of Jimmy Cliff, the voice you know, the story you never heard. Press play. Remember everything. Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. The Sound of Somerton Life Origins in Rural Jamaica. The story of Jimmy Cliff does not begin in the glamour of sold-out arenas or the echo of roaring fans. It begins in the hills of Somerton, St. James, Jamaica, where the air smelled of cane fields and the wind carried the rhythm of rustling banana trees. Born James Chambers on April 1, 1948, he entered a world that was poor in material wealth, but rich in spiritual depth, musical tradition, and communal resilience. Somerton was a village where life moved to the beat of natural soundtracks. Goats bleating, rivers whispering, and hymns rising from small churches on Sunday mornings. Jimmy's father was a tailor and a farmer, a quiet man with rough hands who shaped fabric as skillfully as he shaped the soil. His mother was a domestic worker, a woman of faith and fierce dignity who taught her son that humility was not weakness but strength. Though resources were scarce, love was abundant, and that love wrapped young Jimmy in an invisible armor against the world he was yet to face. Jimmy's early life was textured by the sounds that would shape his soul. There was no internet, no record stores, but the hills of Jamaica had their own way of singing. Folk songs, revivalist chants, the occasional foreign tune that floated in through a transistor radio. Each note etched itself into his subconscious like ancestral code. He would sit under the guinup tree outside his home, humming for hours, creating imaginary melodies, sometimes mimicking animals just to experiment with tone. In church, he sang loud and without shame, his voice already carrying more passion than pitch, more fire than form. He was a child who didn't just hear music, he absorbed it, lived it, let it enter his bloodstream. That spiritual bond with sound became his compass, long before he ever understood the destination. But the Jamaica Jimmy was born into was a country in flux, just a few years away from independence, still crawling out from under British colonialism. Identity was a fluid thing, and for the rural poor, survival often meant silence. But Jimmy was not born to be silent. As he grew, so too did his desire to express, to break out of the box that life had drawn for boys like him. He would walk barefoot through cane fields, dreaming of Kingston, dreaming of big stages, even though he had never seen one. He scribbled lyrics in schoolbooks, often earning punishment for inattention. But to Jimmy, the real education was happening inside his own imagination. It was in primary school that Jimmy's raw talent first made waves. A local teacher heard him singing one day and paused, startled by the depth and soulfulness of the child's voice. Word spread quickly through the village, and soon Jimmy was being asked to perform at school events, church gatherings, and community functions. Each performance added fuel to a fire already raging within him. He began to imitate the few artists he knew of, Fats Domino, Sam Cooke, Louis Jordan. But even then, his sound was different. There was a Jamaican soul in his tone, something earthy, something unpolished and pure. It wasn't mimicry. It was prophecy. When his family relocated briefly to the neighboring district of Adelphi, Jimmy encountered a small record player for the first time in his life. The experience was transformative. The vinyl spun like a portal to another world, and Jimmy stood entranced, listening to American R&B, gospel, and local Mento records. He realized then that sound could travel. If the world could come to him through music, maybe one day he could go out into the world through music too. This idea planted itself like a seed in his chest, one that would grow tall and unyielding. The move to Kingston came not with fanfare, but with the quiet urgency of survival. Still just a teenager, Jimmy convinced his father to let him leave for the capital in search of opportunity. With a few coins in his pocket and fire in his heart, he boarded a truck that would carry him out of the hills and into the unknown. The ride was long, the road unpaved, but Jimmy sat on that truck like a prince on a throne, unaware that the boy from Somerton was about to become the voice of a people. Kingston was chaos. Bustling markets, overcrowded ghettos, men shouting, women cooking, horns blaring, a symphony of survival. Jimmy found himself in the East Kingston area, living in the community of Somerton Avenue, ironically named like his birthplace. But there was no comfort here. Life was rough, and hunger was constant. He hustled odd jobs, sold newspapers, and at night, rehearsed in the shadows with local musicians, some of them just as hungry as he was, for food, for fame, for freedom. He began haunting the doors of recording studios, Treasure Isle, Studio One, Beverly's Records, any place that might give him a shot. He was often turned away, laughed at, told to come back when he was ready. But Jimmy was stubborn. He came back, again and again. And one day, that persistence paid off when Leslie Kong, a Chinese-Jamaican music producer with an ear for talent, gave the boy from Somerton a chance. It was at Kong's Beverly's label that Jimmy would record his first single, Hurricane Hattie, a song inspired by a recent storm that had devastated parts of Jamaica. The track was raw, but it hit hard. It made people stop. It made people listen. That first recording wasn't just the start of a career, it was a spiritual declaration. It said, I exist. I matter. I am here. For Jimmy Cliff, that moment was not about stardom. It was about liberation. The barefoot boy from the hills had crossed the first of many rivers, and on the other side, he found his voice. And that voice, rooted in struggle, blessed by spirit, sharpened by resistance, would become one of the most cinematic sounds in Caribbean music history. Vinyl Dreams in Kingston Streets, the birth of an artist. Kingston did not welcome Jimmy Cliff with open arms. It tested him, beat him down, and stripped him of comfort, but in doing so, it forged a different kind of strength. It was a concrete jungle where dreams lived and died in the same breath, where sound systems roared louder than hunger pains, and where the divide between anonymity and greatness was as thin as the edge of a razor. The boy from Somerton had arrived with only a few belongings and an oversized dream, but he quickly discovered that Kingston didn't care about dreams. What mattered here was grit, survival, and an almost holy belief in oneself. The streets, the ghettos, the zinc-roofed recording shacks, they all became part of Jimmy's initiation into the spiritual warfare of artistry. And from that chaotic birth emerged a voice that would not only rise, but rewire the very DNA of Jamaican music. He slept where he could, on cold floors, in half-finished homes, sometimes not at all. He went days with little to eat, and when food came, it was often a patty or two split between friends. But he didn't complain. He studied. He listened. He absorbed. Every night, the streets turned into music schools. The DJs became professors, the rhythms his textbooks. In places like Raytown, Trenchtown, and Backawall, the youth gathered around towering sound systems that shook the earth. Jimmy would stand there in the crowd, not moving, just listening, internalizing the soul of ska, the bite of mento, the spiritual swagger of rocksteady. One evening, while walking the streets near Orange Street, a stretch later dubbed Beat Street for its musical significance, he stumbled upon a rickety gathering around a corner shop. There, a local DJ was spinning records and allowing raw talent to grab the mic. With trembling hands but unwavering conviction, Jimmy stepped forward. "Me halfy try," he muttered under his breath, and then, without warning, he sang. His voice rang out like prophecy, uncut, defiant, full of pain and promise. The crowd fell into stunned silence before erupting in applause. For many there, that night was the first time they heard the spirit of the hills touch down in the city. Word began to spread, not about a polished star, but about a boy whose voice cracked with truth. The turning point came not just with talent, but with timing. Leslie Kong, the Chinese-Jamaican producer who had given him a shot on Hurricane Hattie, was building momentum as a producer. Kong saw in Jimmy something different. Not just a voice, but a storyteller, a symbol. Their partnership was unlikely, even risky, but it was magic. Kong was methodical, a businessman with vision. Jimmy was untamed, emotional, spiritually driven. Together, they formed a bridge between art and enterprise that would birth some of the earliest recordings that hinted at reggae's global potential. Over the next few years, Cliff began cutting songs that mirrored the consciousness of a country in transition. His lyrics spoke to longing, to hope, to social pain, but always with a melody that lifted the soul. Tracks like Miss Jamaica showcased his ability to blend cultural commentary with mass appeal. He wasn't trying to fit into a mold, he was carving a new one. In a time when most Jamaican artists were still tethered to American R&B structures, Jimmy Cliff was already looking inward, to patois, to spiritual roots, to island vibes that hadn't yet been exported. Yet the city demanded more than music. It demanded image, style, bravado. And so, Jimmy began refining not only his sound, but his look. He wore sharp suits, carefully trimmed hair, and learned the swagger of Kingston's top boys. But beneath the image was still that wide-eyed dreamer, still the barefoot boy, just wearing shoes now. He started reading more. Books on Africa, on Marcus Garvey, on Rastafari. These ideas began shaping his lyrics in subtle but profound ways. Culture was no longer just background, it was the pulse. Kong saw an opportunity. He wanted Jimmy to represent Jamaica on an international stage, to prove that the island's music was more than just novelty. And so, Kong sent Cliff to the UK. It was a bold move. Jimmy was barely out of his teens, and suddenly he found himself in London, cold, gray alien. The move was disorienting, but also electrifying. Here was a world where black music was still boxed into categories, soul, blues, jazz, but Jamaican music had no category yet. Jimmy was about to define it. In England, he faced new challenges. Racism, isolation, industry skepticism. But again, he persisted. He played in clubs, met with producers, recorded tracks that blended the Caribbean sun with British fog. One of those songs, Wonderful World, Beautiful People, would eventually become a breakout hit, an anthem of hope wrapped in reggae warmth. But before the charts, there were hard nights, unanswered calls, and a creeping self-doubt. What kept Jimmy going wasn't ego, it was mission. He believed his voice was meant to carry something bigger than himself, a frequency of liberation. Meanwhile, back in Jamaica, a musical revolution was brewing. Ska was evolving into rocksteady, and the early murmurs of reggae could be heard beneath the bass lines. When Jimmy returned, he brought with him a sense of global vision. His time in the UK hadn't changed him, it had refined him. The artist who once begged for mic time in Kingston was now being courted by record labels in London. He began recording with Island Records, the company that would later also champion Bob Marley. For Jimmy, this wasn't about competition, it was about validation. Jamaican music was no longer a local treasure. It was now a global force. By the time the late 1960s arrived, Jimmy Cliff was no longer just a promising talent. He was a symbol, a young black man from a colonial island, using music to challenge the narrative of the West. Songs like Hard Road to Travel and Vietnam weren't just hits, they were warnings, prayers, and cries for justice. Bob Dylan reportedly called Vietnam the best protest song he'd ever heard. Cliff didn't just sing about resistance, he embodied it. And through all this, he never forgot the streets that raised him. He would often return to Kingston, not as a star, but as a pilgrim. He would walk Beat Street again, stand by sound systems and listen, quietly, to the next generation. He knew that music was a cycle, and his role was to keep it sacred. He was becoming more than a singer. He was a keeper of memory, a griot with a guitar. By the end of this chapter in his journey, Jimmy Cliff had accomplished something few artists ever do. He had become a bridge between Kingston and London, between old world and new world, between suffering and sound. But the greatest proof of his rising power was still to come. Because soon, Jimmy wouldn't just be heard. He would be seen on the big screen. And with that, the world would never see Jamaica the same way again. Reggae's first global voice, the power of music to cross borders. By the dawn of the 1970s, Jimmy Cliff stood on the precipice of something greater than fame. He was becoming the living embodiment of a cultural wave that had no name yet, only rhythm. Jamaican music was mutating, pulsing, preparing to erupt onto the world stage, and Jimmy Cliff was its sharpest spearhead. Long before reggae became a mainstream term, Cliff was planting its seeds across continents, performing in languages he didn't speak, but with emotion everyone understood. His voice, drenched in struggle and hope, was a vessel for messages that defied borders, and by now, his mission was no longer just musical, it was spiritual, political, and cinematic. When Island Records pushed his track, Wonderful World, Beautiful People, into the European market in 1969, something remarkable happened. It charted, not just on a niche list, but on major stations in the UK and even in the United States. The song, gentle but powerful, carried a message of unity that felt necessary in a world reeling from the Vietnam War, racial unrest, and post-colonial confusion. Jimmy Cliff's voice wasn't shouting, it was inviting. He didn't preach, he offered healing. In a musical landscape dominated by American soul and British rock, his island-born melodies felt like a breath of tropical wind, unpolished, but undeniably alive. the global impact of that single song was seismic. For the first time, millions of listeners outside of Jamaica were introduced not just to the sound of reggae, but to its soul. Cliff's lyrics weren't about materialism or fame. They were about the ache of being human in a divided world. And listeners responded. They might not have understood patois or the socio-political nuance behind every word, but they understood emotion. They felt the sincerity. And in that moment, Jimmy Cliff transcended genres. He became the voice of something deeper, the power of music to unify across oceans. Back in Jamaica, this success didn't go unnoticed. Cliff returned home not as a celebrity, but as a hero. Young artists now looked to him as proof that escape was possible, not from Jamaica, but from the limitations the world had placed on Jamaica's voice. His success was not just personal, it was communal, and Jimmy carried that weight with grace. Rather than hoard the spotlight, he began mentoring and supporting other young musicians, those who couldn't yet afford studio time or travel abroad. He knew that one man could not carry a culture. He also knew that his rise had to be a bridge, not a pedestal. In that spirit, Cliff's international performances became almost missionary. In Paris, he sang in theaters once reserved for classical orchestras. In Lagos, he collaborated with Nigerian musicians exploring the rise of Afrobeat. In Sao Paulo, he mesmerized a crowd unfamiliar with reggae, but moved by the cadence of his voice. At every stop, he infused his set with the fire of Jamaican roots, melding it with local instruments, rhythms, and stories. The result? A sound not of Jamaica, but of the diaspora. Cliff had unwittingly become a diplomat of sonic revolution. Perhaps one of the most defining symbols of his global influence was his inclusion on the Catch a Fire tour roster, Island Records' strategic push to launch Jamaican artists into the global market. Cliff's presence signaled legitimacy. He wasn't a novelty act or a background performer. He was the lead, the visionary, the one who had knocked the door open so others like Bob Marley could walk through. And while the world would later center Marley as reggae's messianic figure, insiders knew that Cliff had first mapped the trail. And yet, despite his growing acclaim, Jimmy Cliff remained grounded. He still carried the energy of Somerton in his walk, still believed in the power of humility, and still refused to compromise his message for sales. As industry executives tried to steer him toward more commercial paths, he pushed back. His music remained rooted in meaning. Songs like Many Rivers to Cross captured not only his personal journey, but the journey of Black diaspora consciousness. That song, slow, gospel-infused, aching with vulnerability, became an anthem for immigrants, exiles, and anyone who had ever felt lost in the world. It was featured in countless films, commercials, and covers, but none could match the raw spiritual gravity of the original. He was now a global artist, but still profoundly Jamaican, and that duality came with tension. In Jamaica, some questioned whether he was still one of us. Abroad, he was exoticized, misunderstood, sometimes boxed in as a tropical novelty. But Jimmy Cliff didn't shrink under this pressure. He leaned into it. He expanded it. His next move would silence doubters forever. He would star in a film that would redefine not only his legacy, but the perception of an entire genre. As his name climbed charts and his records crossed continents, Cliff never forgot his duty. He saw music as medicine, especially in an era of cultural resistance. The world was on fire with revolution. Civil rights in the US, decolonization across Africa, anti-imperialist movements in Asia. Cliff's songs didn't just soundtrack these struggles, they belonged to them. Vietnam, one of his most poignant tracks, directly confronted American foreign policy with such honesty that even Bob Dylan publicly praised it. For a Jamaican artist, this wasn't just unusual, it was revolutionary. Jimmy Cliff had weaponized melody into activism. There's a particular concert that remains etched into the mythology of Cliff's journey. It took place in Germany in the early 70s. The crowd, mostly unfamiliar with Caribbean culture, had come out of curiosity. But by the end of the set, hundreds were weeping, holding hands, singing in languages they barely spoke. The journalist covering the event wrote, "Jimmy Cliff didn't perform. He summoned a spirit. That spirit, rooted in roots reggae, carved from ancestral sorrow, layered with joy, was now global." And yet, even as he toured the world, Cliff's eyes remained fixed on his homeland. He knew that fame abroad meant nothing if it didn't elevate his people. He donated equipment to local studios, supported youth projects, and continued to show up in community gatherings unannounced. He wasn't doing it for headlines. He was doing it because he understood what the elders in Somerton had taught him. Your name is only worth the lives it lifts. By the end of this chapter in Jimmy Cliff's life, he had achieved what very few ever do. He had changed how the world listened. Not just to music, but to the voices that had been ignored for too long. Reggae, thanks to his vision and perseverance, was no longer a genre. It was a language, a movement, a heartbeat, and he was its first true global translator. But the world had yet to see his most revolutionary act, the moment when he would not only sing truth, but become it. A rebel with a role that would electrify cinemas, ignite dance halls, and immortalize him in the cultural bloodstream of an entire generation. The harder they come, when a song becomes a revolution. It began with a script, a camera, and a dream, but what it became was nothing short of a cultural earthquake. When Jimmy Cliff accepted the lead role in The Harder They Come in 1972, no one, not even the director Perry Henzell, could have predicted the fire they were about to unleash. It wasn't just about acting. It wasn't just about reggae. It was about changing the global perception of Jamaica from a postcard paradise into a land of defiance, survival, and musical truth. And Cliff, already a rising voice in reggae, would become its cinematic face, embodying a role that blurred the line between fiction and his own lived experience. This was the moment when art, identity, and resistance collided, and the world stood witness. Set in the gritty underbelly of Kingston, The Harder They Come told the story of Ivanhoe Martin, a country boy who dreams of becoming a reggae star, but is instead pulled into the underworld of corruption, police brutality, and survivalism. On paper, it was a film. On screen, it was a rebellion. And at its heart was Jimmy Cliff, whose real-life journey mirrored that of his character too closely to ignore. Like Ivan, Cliff had left the countryside to chase a dream in Kingston. Like Ivan, he had faced rejection, poverty, and exploitation. But unlike Ivan, Jimmy didn't succumb to the system. He reshaped it with rhythm. The film was raw, unforgiving. There were no Hollywood filters, no polished accents. It was Jamaica uncut. Patois flowed freely, violence was unflinching, and the soundtrack, anchored by Cliff's soul-searing voice, carried the weight of generations. Songs like You Can Get It If You Really Want, Many Rivers to Cross, and the title track The Harder They Come didn't just accompany the story, they told it. Every lyric, every chorus, echoed Ivan's arc while doubling as a protest anthem. This wasn't just cinema. This was scripture for the oppressed. The release was modest at first. Jamaican audiences watched with a mixture of pride and discomfort. For the first time, their struggles, their dialect, their lives were reflected on a big screen. There was no exotic romanticism, no sanitized version for Western approval. This was ghetto life with its teeth bared, and it was being told by one of their own. The elite dismissed it, but the streets embraced it like prophecy. Then came the international wave. When The Harder They Come reached theaters in London, New York, and other cultural hubs, it exploded. Film critics couldn't categorize it. Audiences couldn't stop talking about it. Here was a reggae western, a post-colonial fable, and a revolutionary manifesto all wrapped in a single cinematic experience. And at the core of it all was Jimmy Cliff, gritty, magnetic, and heartbreakingly real. He wasn't just acting. He was testifying. Suddenly, Cliff wasn't just a musician. He was a movement. Colleges began screening the film in sociology classes. Political radicals used its soundtrack at rallies. Film historians studied its structure. And young artists across the diaspora, especially Black creatives, saw in Jimmy's performance a roadmap for fusing identity with impact. This wasn't about fame. It was about voice. Cliff had given millions of people a mirror, a language, a rhythm to call their own. But the success came with a price. Jimmy Cliff, once seen as a globally palatable ambassador for reggae, was now the face of raw resistance. Record labels grew uneasy. Some radio stations hesitated to play tracks they deemed too political. And inside Jamaica, tensions brewed between cultural pride and commercial fear. Cliff had crossed a threshold that couldn't be reversed. He was no longer controllable, no longer willing to package his sound to please gatekeepers. He had tasted liberation, and he would never sing in chains again. Privately, Cliff struggled with the dual identity now thrust upon him. Was he a singer or a symbol? An entertainer or a revolutionary? Interviews from that time reveal a man both proud and burdened. He spoke often about responsibility, about how the film had awakened a global hunger for Jamaican truth, and how he felt charged with keeping that truth honest, unfiltered, and sacred. His live shows took on a new energy. They were no longer just performances, they were sermons. He'd walk onto stage barefoot, draped in Rasta colors, guitar slung low, and sing like a man unchained. And when he sang The Harder They Come, crowds didn't just sing along, they shouted it like war chants. Because in that moment, Cliff wasn't just Ivan. He was every freedom fighter who'd ever been told to stay quiet. He was every artist who'd ever been asked to dilute. He was every Jamaican youth who'd ever been told their voice wasn't worth hearing. And still, Jimmy Cliff remained gracious, humble, grounded. He understood that with this new platform came a deeper calling. He spoke at universities, sat with African leaders, opened for civil rights icons. He traveled to Africa, immersing himself in cultures that mirrored his own. From Lagos to Accra to Cape Town, he performed for crowds who saw him not just as a musician, but as a brother in the global black struggle. In one unforgettable moment in Nigeria, Cliff was invited to perform at a Pan-African conference attended by revolutionaries, thinkers, and exiled freedom fighters. He walked onto the stage and sang Many Rivers to Cross, not as entertainment, but as solidarity. And when he finished, the silence in the hall said more than applause ever could. One attendee later said, "That song reminded us that exile was temporary, that we were not alone." The Harder They Come had launched Jimmy Cliff into a different orbit, not of celebrity, but of cultural immortality. He had not only redefined reggae's global image, he had redefined what it meant to be a Jamaican artist. Bold, unapologetic, cinematic, and he did it without ever abandoning the boy from Somerton who sang beneath guinep trees. But revolutions are never still, and neither was Jimmy. The film had made him a legend, but legends cannot rest. They must evolve. And in the years that followed, Cliff would leave behind the glitter of the West to walk deeper into the soul of the African diaspora, searching for sounds, for stories, for himself. Because even after all the applause and acclaim, Jimmy Cliff knew the truth. The harder they come, the harder they fall. And he was not finished rising. Exile and evolution, the Afrobeat connection. When the applause faded and the reels of The Harder They Come stopped spinning in global cinemas, Jimmy Cliff found himself standing at a crossroads, praised by the world, yet distanced from the center of the reggae industry in Jamaica. Despite being the spark that ignited reggae's international fire, Cliff soon discovered that home had shifted while he was away. New voices were rising. New prophets, Marley chief among them, were being crowned. The industry had changed, and so had the narrative. Cliff, who had once been the face of the movement, was now its mythic forerunner, admired but oddly displaced. And in that strange silence, between recognition and rejection, Jimmy did what few stars have the courage to do, he vanished. This chapter of Cliff's life wasn't filled with charts and stage lights. It was filled with reflection, retreat, and rediscovery. He stepped away from the machine of Western fame and turned his gaze toward Africa. Not as a tourist, but as a returning son. He wanted more than rhythms, he wanted roots. And what he found was a deeper layer of himself, buried in the soil of a continent he'd only known through books, stories, and dreams. This wasn't a career move. This was a spiritual pilgrimage. He first traveled to Senegal, then Ghana, eventually making his way through Nigeria and Ethiopia. He performed in villages where electricity flickered, but hearts burned bright. He met drummers who played with calloused palms, griots who sang ancestral memories, and elders who called him brother before knowing his name. In Nigeria, he crossed paths with Fela Kuti, a fiery, brilliant rebel whose Afrobeat had become a force of resistance as fierce as Cliff's reggae. Their meeting wasn't flashy. It was sacred. Two warriors of rhythm, standing in different trenches of the same war. Fela's music, like Jimmy's, was born of unrest. But while Cliff leaned into melody and spiritual uplift, Fela's sound was more jagged, pulsing with political anger and urban chaos. Still, they respected one another deeply. For hours they'd sit in smoky rooms talking about colonialism, sound frequencies, revolution, and the burden of truth-tellers. Fela encouraged Cliff to experiment, to trust the drums more, to let structure bend. In return, Cliff shared with Fela the storytelling craft of reggae, the sacred art of message through melody. Their influence on one another was never commercialized into a flashy album or tour. It was deeper, more invisible. Cliff began to weave Afrobeat textures into his music, not to mimic, but to merge. You could hear it in the rhythm arrangements, in the call and response structure of his live shows, in the breath between notes. He was evolving, not away from Jamaica, but through it, letting the island's pain echo across the continent from which its people had been stolen. During this African Renaissance, Cliff wrote prolifically. Songs that never made it to commercial release. Lyrics scrawled in journals and napkins. Stories that told of lost kingdoms, diaspora children, spiritual exile. He began recording more in analog studios across Africa, collaborating with musicians whose names never made it into liner notes, but whose souls bled into the tape. These recordings, many of which still remain unreleased or buried in private archives, form one of the most haunting chapters of his career. Music as memory, as confession, as ritual. But even as he deepened his bond with Africa, Jimmy Cliff wasn't running from Jamaica. He was building a bridge between what had been severed. He often spoke about the spiritual trauma of slavery, not just the physical brutality, but the disconnection from land, from language, from the drum. And in that context, his time in Africa wasn't escapism. It was reparation. With every performance, every conversation with a village elder, every walk through the streets of Lagos or Addis Ababa, Cliff was piecing himself back together. The exile wasn't punishment, it was the portal. Ironically, it was during this period of spiritual obscurity that his influence reached some of its furthest corners. His music found new life in Brazil, where samba and reggae fused into something locals called reggae de favela. In Japan, Cliff's albums were studied like sacred texts, dissected for their emotion and poetic structure. In the US, soul musicians began borrowing from his phrasing, his lyrical structure. Without seeking the spotlight, Cliff was shaping genres and generations. And yet, even in this period of global worship, the industry's machine remained skeptical. Executives asked him to return to the formula that made him famous. Sing another you can get it. Recreate Wonderful World. But Cliff had already evolved beyond replication. He didn't want to entertain. He wanted to enlighten. And that stubborn fire, so rooted in his childhood under Guinnup trees and revivalist hymns, kept him from compromise. Eventually, he returned to Jamaica. Quietly. No media fanfare. No record launch. Just Jimmy, older, deeper, cloaked in the wisdom of distant lands. And though the industry buzzed with newer voices, Cliff didn't come to compete. He came to connect. He recorded tracks with local producers, mentored young artists, and brought the Afrobeat lessons back to the island. Songs like Peace and Roots Radical reflected that hybrid spirit, Caribbean sun with African soil. It was less about domination now and more about unity. He gave interviews during this era that revealed a man both humbled and emboldened. "I never wanted to be a pop star," he once said. "I wanted to be a voice." He spoke of dreams that had changed, of fame that tasted hollow, of messages that now carried more weight than melodies. In one memorable interview, when asked if he felt overshadowed by Marley's global acclaim, Cliff smiled and said, "Bob was a lion. I was the drum before the roar." This chapter of exile and evolution didn't have chart-topping singles or arena tours. It had something far more eternal, soul work. It was the part of Jimmy Cliff's journey that most fans never saw, but one that echoed in every note he sang afterward. His music became slower, deeper, more spiritual. Not always radio-friendly, but always real. He wasn't chasing charts anymore. He was chasing clarity. In the years that followed, artists like Burna Boy, Chronix, and Damian Marley would name Cliff as a silent mentor, someone whose boundary-breaking paved the way for Afro-Caribbean musical fusion. And in that fusion lay the future, a sound that transcended flag, language, and border. Jimmy Cliff hadn't vanished. He had simply planted himself elsewhere, and now his roots were blooming across the diaspora. As he prepared to re-enter the industry spotlight, Cliff was no longer just an icon. He was a mystic, a griot, a bridge. And with the lessons of exile in his heart and Africa's rhythm in his blood, he was ready to bring something new to Jamaica. Something born of silence, of shadow, of soul. Because Real artists don't just return. They resurrect. Island Fire, Clash with Industry, returned to roots. When Jimmy Cliff returned to Jamaica from his spiritual and sonic pilgrimage across Africa and beyond, he wasn't the same man who had once walked barefoot across Kingston's hungry streets. He returned not as a prodigal son seeking redemption, but as a man who had tasted the full arc of exile, its loneliness, its lessons, and its light. Yet despite the spiritual depth and global wisdom he now carried, what awaited him on his home soil wasn't an embrace. It was resistance. The island had moved on. The industry had become territorial. And the artist who had once shattered ceilings was now seen, by some, as a relic, an echo of an era overtaken by new idols and commercial machinery. But Jimmy Cliff had never been one to beg for approval. What he sought now was fire, island fire. And he would spark it by reclaiming the only thing that ever truly belonged to him, the message in the music. The clash with the industry was not loud at first. It began in small moments, conversations with producers who encouraged him to soften his message, record executives who pushed him to replicate past hits instead of exploring new truths. The music landscape in Jamaica had shifted. Dancehall was rising. Artists like Shabba Ranks and later Vybz Kartel would dominate airwaves with edgier, street-centric lyrics and digital rhythms. Cliff's conscious, melody-driven style now felt, at least to commercial minds, outdated. But he refused to be manipulated. He had walked through fire in Lagos. He had sung for revolutionaries in Soweto. He wasn't about to bow to charts or algorithms. He recentered his creative life in Jamaica's hills, far from Kingston's glittering studios and politics. In the quiet of nature, he began building what he called his music sanctuary, a small home studio surrounded by trees, birds, and the heartbeat of island life. It was here, in this stripped-down environment, that Jimmy began to rediscover his core, spiritual lyrics, acoustic sessions, and rhythms guided not by trends, but by ancestral memory. The sound that emerged from those sessions was raw, honest, and defiant. And the first project to fully capture that spirit was Cliff Hanger, his 1985 Grammy-winning album. Cliff Hanger was a reintroduction and a declaration. Tracks like Hitting with Music and American Sweet told stories that industry radio didn't want to hear, of cultural erasure, of capitalist exploitation, of the soul sickness in Western systems. Yet, even as some program directors ignored him, the album caught the attention of critics and thinkers around the globe. Jimmy wasn't singing for airplay. He was singing for awareness. And the world took note. The real breakthrough of this era, though, was not commercial. It was philosophical. Jimmy Cliff had finally accepted that his journey was not to be the next Marley or the first global reggae star. His calling was older, more sacred. He was a cultural keeper, a witness, a torchbearer. And with that clarity came a new creative confidence. He began to experiment again, fusing traditional Nyabingi drumming with electronic pulses, writing songs in multiple languages, and even exploring film scores. He saw no contradiction in tradition and innovation. For Jimmy, they were the same drum, beating from opposite ends of the timeline. But not everyone welcomed this creative rebellion. Industry heads grew frustrated. He turned down major label offers that didn't grant full artistic control. He walked away from lucrative deals if they came with moral compromise. And at times, he paid the price. Some of his most powerful work from this period was underpromoted, shelved, or dismissed by gatekeepers afraid of anything that sounded too radical. But still, he pressed on. It was during this phase that Jimmy found himself gravitating back to the people. He began doing smaller concerts in Jamaican communities, often unannounced. He'd show up in Montego Bay, in Savannah-Lamar, in Clarendon, just him, his guitar, and his truth. These weren't performances. They were gatherings. Elders wept. Children danced barefoot. Rastas nodded in silent approval. For them, Jimmy wasn't a superstar. He was a vessel. He also began speaking more openly in interviews about colonial education systems, about the loss of cultural memory, about the need for Black people globally to reclaim identity through art. He was no longer just reflecting society. He was challenging it, provoking it, asking uncomfortable questions. And slowly, those conversations began to shift the cultural dialogue. In his music, the tension between resistance and return became clearer. One moment he'd deliver a love song steeped in tropical warmth. The next he'd drop a verse about blood diamonds or neo-colonial debt. His lyrics blurred the line between the personal and the political, between the intimate and the universal. On tracks like Reggae Night, a later commercial hit, he proved he could still dominate the dance floor, but even then, embedded beneath the groove was a quiet message. Remember who you are. And perhaps the most powerful symbol of this period was not a song, but a silence. For nearly a decade, Jimmy turned down multiple opportunities to rejoin the mainstream spotlight. He was offered reunion tours, movie roles, and brand endorsements. But unless the message aligned, he said no. In a world obsessed with visibility, he chose integrity. And in that choice, his legend only deepened. Eventually, the world came back around. Young musicians, critics, and scholars began to revisit his catalog. Documentaries began tracing his influence. His songs appeared in new films, in protest marches, in UN conferences. The industry that once pushed him aside now called him a founding father. But Cliff, ever humble, brushed aside the labels. "I'm just singing truth," he said once. "And truth don't need a spotlight. It finds its own echo." By the end of this chapter, it was clear, Jimmy Cliff didn't return to Jamaica to reclaim his crown. He returned to remind the kingdom why it mattered. He rekindled the fire not in stadiums, but in schoolyards, sound systems, and sacred gatherings. He reminded an island of its pulse, its pain, and its promise. And through that return to roots, through that refusal to fade quietly, he ensured that his legacy would not be carved in awards, but in awakening. Vybz Kartel, Bob Marley, and the shadow of legacy. Legacy is a heavy crown, especially when worn by a pioneer. As Jimmy Cliff moved through the later phases of his career, he found himself not only revered but dissected. People began comparing him, measuring him against the mythos of Bob Marley, the rise of newer dancehall legends like Vybz Kartel, and the ever-evolving soundscape of Jamaican music. It was no longer just about what Jimmy had accomplished. It was about where he stood in the narrative Jamaica was writing about itself. And in a nation with a complicated relationship to both reverence and rebellion, Jimmy Cliff's legacy became a mirror through which Jamaica examined its past, wrestled with its present, and imagined its future. By the early 2000s, Jimmy Cliff's influence had traveled so far that it was almost invisible, woven into the DNA of every reggae band, every socially conscious lyricist, every artist who used music as both uplift and protest. But the conversation on the streets of Kingston had shifted. The youth were no longer talking about the harder they come. They were quoting Kartel, clashing to rhythms that pulsed with urban rawness, and worshiping new kings whose truths were less about spiritual uplift and more about survival in a brutal modern Jamaica. In that space, some critics wondered, had Jimmy Cliff's message become irrelevant? But those who understood the deeper current of music culture knew better. Cliff had planted seeds in every genre that sprouted after him, even if the artists who grew from that soil didn't always realize it. Bob Marley's legacy had, by then, been immortalized. He was the martyr, the prophet, the worldwide face of reggae. Statues, murals, UNESCO recognitions, all bore his likeness. And while Cliff deeply respected Bob, he also knew the truth behind the timelines. Before Marley ruled the world, Jimmy Cliff broke the gates. In fact, it was Cliff's success that first caught the attention of Island Records founder Chris Blackwell. When Bob Marley and the Wailers were signed, it was Cliff's blueprint they followed. The international crossover, the conscious lyrics, the cinematic visual style. Cliff never resented Bob for becoming the icon. He just wanted the world to remember that the trail had not appeared magically. It had been cut by his machete. And yet, despite their overlapping legacies, Cliff and Marley had always walked different paths. Where Marley became the symbol of Rastafari and political revolution, Cliff remained more fluid, spiritual but non-dogmatic, revolutionary but rooted in personal healing. His refusal to be easily boxed may have cost him mainstream idol status, but it gave him something rarer, authenticity. While Marley became the face, Cliff became the soul, a quieter force, but one just as enduring. Then there was Vybz Kartel, a completely different force. Dancehall's most controversial and compelling figure, Kartel represented the unfiltered voice of the ghetto, gritty, vulgar, poetic, and prophetic in his own dark way. Some viewed him as Cliff's antithesis. But Cliff, he saw Kartel as part of the continuum. "Every generation has its message," he said in an interview. Kartel speaks from his trenches. "I spoke from mine." Cliff never criticized Kartel's lyrical choices, even when others did. Instead, he offered a broader lens. Dancehall is the cry of the now, but roots reggae is the drum of the eternal. What Cliff understood, perhaps better than anyone, was that music is not a monolith. It evolves. It fragments. But it never forgets its root frequency. And that frequency was forged in the hills of Jamaica, by voices like his that dared to sing truth before it was fashionable. He recognized the value in Kartel's rebelliousness, just as he valued Marley's righteousness. For Cliff, both were necessary. Both were Jamaican. Both were valid. He wasn't interested in who ruled the airwaves. He was listening to who held the heartbeat. Still, the shadow of legacy can weigh heavy. In multiple interviews throughout the 2010s, Cliff was asked to rank himself in the reggae pantheon. Always he refused. "That's not my business," he would say. "I'm not in competition with Bob or Kartel or anyone. I just sing truth." Let time decide the rest. But time, ironically, had already begun speaking. His songs were still being used in global documentaries, films, and activist campaigns. His lyrics were quoted in universities and even in sermons. And unlike many of his contemporaries, Cliff's influence had transcended generation, genre, and geography. Perhaps the clearest sign of Cliff's enduring relevance came when young artists began rediscovering him. Not through old vinyl, but through samples. Producers in the US hip-hop scene began looping Many Rivers to Cross. EDM artists sampled You Can Get It If You Really Want. Even in grime and Afrobeats, echoes of Cliff's phrasing could be heard. Without trying, without branding campaigns or TikTok trends, Jimmy Cliff had remained culturally immortal. He also began collaborating with younger talents, not as a relic brought in for nostalgia, but as a mentor. He worked with artists like Wyclef Jean, Modest Yahoo, and Khalifa on crossover tracks that respected his roots while reimagining his sound. Always humble, he listened more than he spoke in studio sessions, offering suggestions like a wise elder, not a fading star. These collaborations proved something vital. Cliff was never stuck in the past. He was just grounded in it. And that grounding allowed him to stretch, adapt, and evolve without losing his core. By the late 2010s, Cliff's name began returning to global headlines, award ceremonies, lifetime achievement honors, Hall of Fame inductions. But Jimmy remained unmoved by applause. "It's nice," he'd say. "But the real reward is when someone tells me a song kept them going during dark times." For him, music was never about charts. It was about connection. He had sung for the poor, the exiled, the hopeful, and the heartbroken. He didn't need statues. His legacy lived in memory, in feeling, in fire. In Jamaica, as murals of Marley stood tall in town squares, new ones of Cliff began appearing too. In schoolyards, in Rasta camps, in grassroots art movements. Not just as a reggae pioneer, but as a cultural father. A keeper of rhythm. A drum that beat before the words arrived. Legacy, Cliff had learned, was not about being seen. It was about being felt. And across generations, genres, and continents, Jimmy Cliff had become the invisible thread that tied Jamaica's musical tapestry together. Marley was the flame. Cartel was the spark. But Cliff was the wood, the foundation that allowed the fire to burn. And his story was far from over. Sacred Rhythms, Jimmy Cliff's spiritual awakening. Some artists search the world for success, others search within. By the time Jimmy Cliff entered the final arc of his public journey, having conquered stages across continents and etched his name in music history, the search for validation had ended. What remained was a deeper hunger. One not for charts, applause, or legacy, but for alignment. Cliff had reached a point few artists ever do. The point where fame becomes quiet and the soul becomes loud. And in that sacred silence, Cliff began to listen, not to producers or critics, but to something older. Something divine. Something eternal. It was here that Jimmy Cliff, reggae's cinematic revolutionary, became Jimmy Cliff, spiritual traveler. He spoke of it often, but few truly heard him. Beneath the melodies, beneath the interviews and headlines, was a man on a path, toward God, toward light, toward the rhythm that lives beneath all sound. His lyrics began to shift subtly, then dramatically. Where once there were songs about love and rebellion, now came invocations, meditations, sacred hymns wrapped in the DNA of reggae. It wasn't a rejection of his past, it was a culmination of it. All the exile, all the fire, all the struggle had prepared him for this. A return not to Jamaica, but to spirit. Jimmy had always been spiritual. Even as a child in Somerton, his earliest memories were shaped by hymns and revivalist chants echoing through the bush. But now, decades later, those echoes had matured into understanding. He began exploring Rastafari not as a religion, but as a philosophy, a way of living in rhythm with creation, with Africa, with divine order. He studied Islam, Christianity, even Buddhism. He saw unity in all paths and believed that music was the thread that connected them. "God is music," he once said in a now famous interview. Music is the one language that's never been colonized. And from that revelation came a new wave of artistry. His 2012 album Rebirth was more than a title. It was a statement of spiritual intent. Tracks like One More and World Upside Down weren't crafted to please radio. They were crafted to realign frequency. You could feel the difference. The vocals were raw but deliberate. The lyrics felt like scripture, coded messages wrapped in melody. Cliff wasn't just recording songs. He was channeling. He also began living differently. Gone were the industry entourages and constant travel. He spent long periods in meditation, fasting, and silence. Friends and collaborators would visit and speak of an energy around him, calm, grounded, fierce in its serenity. One artist described him as a walking Nyabingi drum, pulsing with ancestral rhythm, quiet but unmistakable. His stage shows transformed too. He still played the classics, but now they were framed with intention. Before performing Many Rivers to Cross, he would often speak softly to the audience about spiritual endurance. Before The Harder They Come, he'd remind people that resistance was not just political, but internal, a war against ego, fear, and forgetfulness of who we are. It wasn't performance anymore. It was ritual. But Cliff's awakening didn't isolate him. It expanded him. He began working with cultural elders, youth programs, and healers across the Caribbean and Africa. He helped fund spiritual retreats, supported prison ministries, and offered private mentorship to young artists facing mental health struggles. He saw himself not as a guru, but as a reminder. His message was clear. The industry will try to own your image, but only you can protect your soul. In his music, this clarity rang out. Songs like Humanitarian and No Justice weren't pleas. They were spiritual diagnoses of a world out of rhythm. He refused to dilute the message, even as some labels hesitated to release it. He didn't care. "I record for the future," he said, "not the charts." And true to his word, that music found life in unexpected places. In classrooms, in churches, in refugee camps where his songs played on donated speakers, offering hope to the displaced. Privately, Cliff began writing what he called his Songbook of Light, a personal journal of lyrics, prayers, meditations, and dreams. He spoke of creating a final body of work not meant for commercial release, but for spiritual archives, to be accessed only when the world was ready to hear again. "There will come a time," he said, "when silence will feel louder than music. That's when they'll hear what I've been singing all along." As his physical body began to slow, his spirit seemed to intensify. At concerts, he would sometimes pause mid-song, close his eyes, and let minutes pass in stillness. Audiences didn't grow restless. They grew reverent. They felt it, that something ancient was standing before them. A man, a song, a vessel. Jimmy Cliff was no longer performing. He was remembering. And in remembering, he was awakening something in all of us. He talked more about the afterlife, not in fear, but in preparation. He said he wasn't afraid of death because he had already died many times, died to ego, to illusion, to the systems that tried to name him. What he lived for now was alignment, and music, for him, was the breath of the divine. "If I sing it, I must be it," he said. No separation. In these final chapters of his career, Jimmy Cliff transcended genre, status, and even time. He had become what few artists ever do, a frequency, a sacred rhythm. A living reminder that music is not just entertainment. It is memory. It is prophecy. It is spirit made sound. And when people asked him what he wanted to be remembered for, he would smile softly and say, "Not for what I sang, but for why I sang." The many rivers he crossed, awards, honors, and the long view. By the time Jimmy Cliff reached his seventh decade, the world had caught up to what he had always known. That his voice wasn't just music, it was memory. It was resistance. It was prophecy. The barefoot boy from Somerton who once sang hymns under mango trees had crossed oceans, broken barriers, challenged systems, and softened hearts. And now, as time began to slow, the world turned to him with a different posture. No longer asking who he was, but declaring what he meant. Honors began to pour in like ancestral rain, late, perhaps, but heavy with truth. And Cliff, ever humble, received each with a quiet fire, never mistaking the trophy for the triumph. The journey to recognition wasn't sudden, it was cumulative. His induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2010 was symbolic not just because he was a reggae artist breaking into a space often dominated by Western icons, but because it served as global acknowledgement that reggae itself was more than a genre. It was a movement, and Cliff had been one of its earliest, fiercest messengers. Standing beneath the hall's lights, he didn't speak of fame. He spoke of freedom. He thanked the ancestors. He reminded the audience that rhythm came before language, and that his music had always been about awakening. The awards kept coming. Jamaica's Order of Merit, the country's third highest national honor, recognized him not just for artistry, but for cultural impact. It was a full circle moment. The same island that once questioned his relevance, that once leaned more toward Marley's fire or Cartel's rawness, now embrace Jimmy Cliff as a national monument, not carved in stone, but carried in spirit. The people who once danced to his protest songs now taught their grandchildren the words. And when he walked through Kingston's streets, it wasn't as a celebrity, it was as an elder, a griot, a teacher. But for Cliff, the true honors were never the medals. They were the echoes. The child in Soweto singing, "You can get it if you really want." The refugee in Palestine using many rivers to cross as a prayer. The climate activist in Brazil who cited Vietnam as a soundtrack for justice. Jimmy understood something that many artists never do, that the real measure of success is in the unseen ripples. The ways a song, once released, travels without passport or permission and touches souls that charts can't quantify. He once said, "If a man gets a million plays but makes no one feel, he is nothing. If a song gets one play and saves a life, it is everything." That was Jimmy Cliff's metric. Not Billboard, not YouTube views, impact, soul print, cultural resonance. Still, he was gracious in his acceptance of accolades. He appeared on panels, gave speeches in schools, and sat down for interviews with scholars dissecting his contribution to global Black consciousness. And through it all, he never made it about himself. He made it about us. About the struggle of the colonized to find voice. About the right to sing truth without dilution. About the sacred duty of artists to serve something bigger than profit. In later years, Cliff began to write more essays and give spiritual talks. He would speak of musical ancestry, the idea that artists carry the unhealed trauma and untold triumphs of those who came before. He viewed every award not as a trophy, but as a reminder of unfinished work. "This honor," he once said, holding a lifetime achievement plaque, "belongs to the slaves who never got to sing, to the dreamers who died with their songs still in their chest." He reflected often on mortality, not in sadness, but in preparation. He spoke of legacy not as a monument left behind, but as a light passed forward. And in that spirit, he began mentoring more deliberately. Not just artists, but organizers, healers, youth leaders. He saw them all as musicians, each playing a part in the great orchestra of liberation. And through these intimate relationships, Jimmy Cliff's work multiplied. Quietly, organically, eternally. And yet, even as accolades piled up and his name was etched into plaques, Jimmy never forgot the rivers he had crossed. The betrayals, the industry politics, the cultural erasure, the years of being ignored, only to be celebrated later. He carried all of it, not with bitterness, but with balance. It gave depth to his laughter. It made his joy sharper, his gratitude deeper. He had walked through fire barefoot and emerged with a song still in his throat. His final performances in this era were sacred events, not concerts, ceremonies. He sang like a man offering blessings. The crowd, often multi-generational, knew they were witnessing more than entertainment. They were standing in the presence of living memory. Elders wept, children swayed. Every lyric was a bridge between past and future, suffering and survival. One of his final major recognitions came not from the music industry, but from a coalition of global peace activists who awarded him for a lifetime contribution to consciousness through art. In his acceptance speech, he said only this: "I did not come to entertain. I came to remind. And if you remember, then I have done my job." As the lights dimmed and the curtain drew nearer, Jimmy Cliff stood not as a man celebrated by the world, but as a man who had walked through it all, wounded, wise, and whole. The rivers he crossed were many. Some were muddy with betrayal, others cold with exile. But each one carved a deeper path through the terrain of human truth. And through every current, through every tide, Jimmy Cliff carried the same thing. A voice. A drum. A song no system could silence. Still standing, Jimmy Cliff in the modern era. Time moves fast, but legends move differently. As the digital age unfolded, as algorithms replaced soul, and as musical trends shifted by the hour, many thought Jimmy Cliff would retreat into the shadows, gracefully aged, remembered but not active. But Cliff had never moved by the rhythms of the industry. He had always moved by the beat of the ancestral drum, the one that doesn't fade with fashion, the one that doesn't care for TikTok hits or streaming charts. And so against all expectation, Jimmy Cliff remained, still standing, still singing, still resonating, a living bridge between generations, continents, and consciousness. In the 2020s, he could have rested. He had nothing left to prove. He had awards, international recognition, generational impact. But rest was not in his design. Instead, Cliff embraced a quiet renaissance. He returned to the studio, not to chase trends, but to capture reflections. His voice, weathered yet powerful, now carried the weight of time. Each lyric sounded like it had been carved from stone. And what he recorded in these years was deeply introspective, socially alert, and spiritually luminous. Albums like Bridges and singles like Refugees weren't attempts to reclaim youth. They were meditations on the state of the world, delivered by a voice the world had never stopped needing. In these new works, Cliff addressed the modern era with fearless clarity. He sang of climate collapse, digital disconnection, migrant suffering, and racial trauma, not with rage, but with reverence. His lyrics were warnings and prayers at once. And remarkably, they found new ears. Young activists shared his songs in protest reels. Documentarians scored their films with his voice. Even in playlists dominated by auto-tuned club beats, his message cut through like sunlight through fog. And the artists of the new era? They listened. They learned. Jimmy Cliff became a mentor not through scheduled sessions or flashy features, but by existing. His legacy was now a blueprint for authenticity. When Chronix released Here Comes Trouble, when Protoge crafted albums of roots fusion, when Damian Marley redefined political lyricism, Cliff's fingerprints were everywhere. He wasn't a ghost in the background, he was a pulse in the foundation. Beyond music, Jimmy became a global elder. He was invited to peace forums, African cultural summits, and international youth movements. He sat on panels beside thought leaders, spiritualists, and revolutionaries, offering wisdom with the humility of a farmer and the clarity of a prophet. He no longer needed to convince anyone of his message. He embodied it. When he spoke of unity, it wasn't theoretical, it was lived. When he sang of love, it wasn't romantic, it was universal. In Jamaica, his presence was quieter, but even more sacred. He could be seen walking in the hills at dawn, greeting elders, pausing to speak to schoolchildren. When asked for photos, he smiled, never out of ego, but gratitude. He understood now that he had become more than a musician. He was a living archive, a sacred text still turning its pages in real time. And yet, despite all the reverence, Jimmy Cliff remained grounded. He still joked, still cooked Ital food, still played guitar barefoot. In interviews, he laughed easily, never taking the fame seriously. He often said, "The song is not the goal. The soul is." And it showed. His modern music videos were simple. Nature. Faces. Fire. Rain. They weren't about spectacle. They were about essence. He had no need for filters. He had become his own lens. Even in his aging body, Cliff remained vibrant. He exercised daily. Ate clean. Meditated often. Friends described him as lighter than air, deeper than sea. And in the middle of a world addicted to noise, Cliff became a quiet revolution. His songs reminded people of their inner compass, of truth that can't be streamed or downloaded, of freedom that can't be monetized. Then came a moment in 2022 that reminded the world, Jimmy Cliff is not done. With the release of Refugees, featuring Wyclef Jean, Cliff re-entered global conversations with staggering relevance. The song, urgent and haunting, addressed the displacement of people across the globe. Syria, Haiti, Africa, the Caribbean. Jimmy's voice, woven with Wyclef's, created a spiritual anthem that felt like it belonged in both a cathedral and a protest march. Critics praised the song. Fans called it timeless. And youth, who had never heard The Harder They Come, now sang his lyrics on Instagram stories and Spotify streams. He had never left. As his 80th birthday neared, there were talks of documentaries, biopics, and tribute albums. But Jimmy, in his essence, remained uninterested in monuments. "Let the music speak," he said. "Let the rivers run." He didn't seek to be remembered. He sought to remind. And perhaps that is why he continues to matter, because he lives in the now, not the nostalgia. And when asked if he planned to stop recording, Cliff smiled and answered, "Not until the drum stops beating." And the drum's still loud. So here he stands, not just as the man who brought reggae to the world, not just as the first global voice of Jamaican soul, not just as a bridge between Somerton and the Sahara, but as a living prayer, a sacred rhythm in a world desperate for harmony. Jimmy Cliff is still standing, still singing, still reminding us that many rivers may come, but truth, when sung with courage, always flows.